I'm Mark Minnelli. How well do you know yourself and understand those you live, work, and come in contact with? Sounds like a trite question, I know. But think about how much trouble you'd save yourself and others if you better understood why you think and feel the way you do, and how your thoughts and emotions interact to determine your behavior. We'll talk about improving our sensibility with Doris Wild Helmering. St. Louis on the Air follows the news. And this is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Mark Minnelli. Doris Wild Helmering is a psychotherapist who lives in St. Louis, and for the past 20 years, she's written a column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's the author of 8 books, the latest of which is Sensibility, Expanding Your Sense of Awareness for a 21st Century Life. You can join our conversation today with Doris Wild Helmering with just a phone call, as always, to 382-8255-382-TALK. And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on, Mark.
Thanks for being here. The title of the book is Sensibility. That's 2 words.
Right.
Tell us what that means. What is sensibility?
Well, sensibility is, if I translate it, I could say it's using your common sense. It's really the ability to become self-aware, to step back from yourself, become sort of an impartial observer of yourself, and really watch yourself. Watch the way you think. Watch the way you feel and watch the way you behave and also the way you interact with other people. And if more people would do that, of course, they would have better marriages. Certainly they could stop fighting with their kids almost instantly. They would have better relationships at work. But most of us tend to look at other people and we see other people and their flaws, and we tend not to be willing or not able to step back and look at ourselves. So that's what I really invite people to do. And in fact, I actually start the book with something that happened to me last summer on vacation. Several of us were standing in line, and we were waiting for coffee. And all of a sudden, this guy kind of nudges his way up to the counter, and he tells the server what he wants. And, you know, she said very nicely, you know, sir, I'll be with you in just a moment. And then she continued to wait on us. And all of a sudden, this guy takes his fist and slams it down on the table and says, "This is ridiculous. I'm not waiting." And he kind of marches off. And his wife is with him, and you can see, you know, her pain and her discomfort, and she's trying to placate the guy. Now, this guy did not have much self-awareness. And if he had, he would have really seen that he was trying to bulldoze certainly the server and probably us, too, with his anger.
Sure.
He was trying to control the situation. And he certainly wasn't aware that there were others of us waiting in line. And, you know, he could have thought different thoughts. He could have thought, this place is too busy. It's a shame they don't have more people, you know, right now waiting on these people. He could have said, you know, I really want coffee, but we'll have to go down the block because I don't have much time to wait. Or I can just wait and kind of people watch and talk to my wife, use this as an opportunity. So if he had become more self-aware, he could have made those choices. You know, the best response in a given situation is to kind of step back and think about it and not to always use the same automatic response pattern. And my guess is this guy's automatic response pattern when things don't go his way is to become angry.
Who is this guy anyway? He pops up in lines everywhere.
You've seen him too, huh?
I want to know who this guy is and how he gets around. You use the word, the term, common sense.
Right.
You know, and I am not sure that that's a term a lot of people might associate with psychotherapy.
Well, I think that more people really do need to use their common sense, because most of us really know when we're too critical. We know that we talk too much. We know that we have an anger problem. We know that we step on other people's toes, and yet we keep doing it. In fact, with the example of talking too much, you know, I have a number of women who have come to me in therapy, and it's not all women, but women do tend to be a little bit more yakky than men. You haven't noticed
that. I won't go there.
And in fact, women talk 25,000 words a day, and they have now measured that men talk about 12 or 13,000 words a day. So I'm always telling women, well, you know, by the time your husband comes home, he's talked out. Where you, on the other hand, you know, you still have another 12,000 words to go.
And in fact, thank you. I'm going to use that.
Even in utero, you know, a female fetus, actually, their jaws move more than men. I mean, I think that's a riot when I read that research, but I understand. But anyway, a lot of women.
Proof.
That's right. Don't tell your wife where you got to. But a lot of women tell me, you know I talk too much. And I think, well, my gosh, if you know you talk too much, talk less. You don't have to fill in every silence at a party. You don't have to keep going on and on and on or shifting the conversation to what you want to talk about. Talk less then. And so it's like one step is to become aware, to kind of pull back, become that impartial observer. And then the next step, of course, is to do something about these issues.
Is this sensibility something we are born with, or do we need, is it a skill we need to learn?
Well, it's both. We are definitely born with some sensibility in that we, you know, kind of scope out what's going on around us, and so we start making adjustments to our thinking or our feelings or our behavior. But as we grow, then we develop that more and more, so that when I'm talking to you, I'm really using my sensibility to determine if I'm getting my point across or not. And I'm picking up on all kinds of cues. When I meet a new friend, I might use that ability to decide how much information to disclose to that person in the very beginning. So I'm always, or if I do a presentation, you know, am I getting my point across? I might use it to check out my mood in the morning. How do I feel? I might use it with my child to check out, you know, what's going on with him. And so it's a sense that we are really born with. And some people make much more use of it, of course, than others. One of the things I talk about is, you know, before we had cataract surgery, there were children who were born with cataracts. Our children who developed cataracts, we'll say, when they were 2 or 3 years old, and they really couldn't remove those cataracts because they didn't have the technology then. And what happened was is that those children, of course, were blind. But when that surgery, when they could all of a sudden do that surgery, what happened was they were able then to remove those cataracts, and all of a sudden the children had perfect sight, but they still couldn't see. And the reason that they couldn't see, and it was particularly devastating, or I mean it was profound what happened with people in their 20s and 30s, that all of a sudden they had this perfect sight, but they couldn't see.
They and couldn't use it.
They could not use it, right. And the reason is because they had not developed it. And so I can remember one of the interesting stories was that this man could not distinguish his wife's face from that of another woman, but when he heard her voice, he knew exactly who she was. And then there was another fellow that was presented with this big bunch of whatever, and he had no idea what he was looking at, but when he caught a whiff of this whatever, he found out that, and he declared, oh my gosh, yellow daffodils. So what happened was is that they had developed their other senses much more acutely, but they had not developed their sense of sight. And it took sometimes months and sometimes years for people to develop their sense of sight. And it's the same thing with our sense of awareness, our sensibility. I think it takes us a whole lifetime to really develop that. But the push is to keep stepping back from yourself and really looking at yourself.
We are talking with Doris Wild-Helmering, psychotherapist and columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You're listening to St. Louis on the Air on 90.7 KWMU. And our number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 382-8255, 382-TALK. You talk about so many different things in this book. You spend a lot of time, it seems, talking about anger and people being critical. And it seems as a society, we are getting angrier and angrier, or maybe it's just that we are displaying our anger more. We're more ready to anger. We hold grudges. What do you think is happening? Why are we so angry?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't know if we're a more angry society, but I certainly think we have given ourselves permission to display our anger more. And I have to say I hold my profession somewhat responsible for that because, you know,
I'm glad you said that because I was going to ask you about that.
It's true. In the 30s and 40s, what happened was is people would be quiet with their anger and they would put it away and mostly it would dissipate and that's that. All right. Yeah, there were some people, you know, you would hear about the the two fighting factions, the McCaws and whatever, yeah. Okay, or the O'Reillys. But mostly people would put their anger away and it would dissipate. But today we have given ourselves a lot more permission to express our anger outwardly. And so I think what goes on, though, is that there's a lot of people who are what I call hot burners. And these are people who have truly a genetic inclination to be angry. They have much more of a high excitability and also intensity about them. And so stimuli tend to bother them much more than other people. And so what happens is that somebody cuts them off in line and they're instantly angry. Well, you know, it takes less than a second to become angry. And what happens is that you immediately, when someone does something to you that you perceive as an injustice and you don't like, you initially feel fear. And that's why we always say that anger is fear-based, because there's always some fear underneath the anger. Or it's a threat. Your kid doesn't do what he's supposed to do, or your husband hasn't done what he's supposed to do. So that's fear-based, because we think we're losing our power, our people are not listening to us. But we also add to that negative thinking. And it's usually, well, for example, George doesn't put out the trash. And you see that the trash can is not out there on a Tuesday morning. And immediately you go to, I can't count on that guy for anything. He never does anything, he says, around here. And, you know, by the time you get to work, you've already divided the furniture up in your head and decided, yes, what lawyer you're going to call, right? Well, that particular those negative thoughts is what really drives our anger. And what I teach people is, come on, guys, you got to step back and you got to watch the thoughts that you think. You know, thinking is like breathing. We don't think about breathing, except when I talk to you about it. Or all of a sudden you can't breathe or you start to choke. Then you think about your breath, but otherwise you don't. But it's something that we always do. And it's the same thing with thinking. It's something that we always do. You know, we think 60,000 thoughts a day. And so what you have to do is you have to be careful what thoughts you think. And lots of people get themselves in trouble because they immediately jump to anger, and that's really their automatic response pattern, just like that guy talked about standing in line.
And we allow those thoughts, or one or two of those thoughts, to seemingly dominate our whole day.
Right. They just kind of grab us. And the deal is that feelings only last 3 seconds unless we continue to think thoughts. And that's all they last. So nobody can have really an excuse to have a bad temper, because feelings only last 3 seconds. And, you know, we would be very ineffective humans if they lasted longer. Here's an example. Suppose I'm hiking in the North Woods, right, and I come across a big bear. Well, I'm going to feel a whole lot of fear, all right? But I better get out of my fear real fast and think, what in the heck am I going to do?
Run.
Well, you know what?
Or whatever.
He'd probably run. In fact, when I was writing this book, I go away to write, and I was up in this cabin by myself and working like crazy on this book. And the bears were coming somewhat down from the mountains because it was very dry that season. And so I slept with a shovel next to my bed. And I remember saying one night to my husband, we were talking on the telephone, and I said, do you think I could protect myself with this shovel? And he said, no, but I think you give it one heck of a bloody nose before it killed you.
We need to go and go on a break right now. We will take that break, come back, continue our conversation with Doris Wild-Helmering. Our number is 382-8255, 382-TALK. Back in 1 minute on St. Louis on the Air on 90.7 KWMU. Back at St. Louis on the Air. I'm Mark Minnelli. With me today is Doris Wild Helmering. You have probably read her column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She is a psychotherapist and author of 8 books, the latest of which is Sensibility. That's 2 words, Sensibility, Expanding Your Sense of Awareness for a 21st Century Life. And you're invited to join the conversation with your questions and comments, 382-8255, 382-TALK. I wanted to ask you, because I don't know if it's an opposite, but when you talk about anger, you also spend a great deal of time in the book talking about love. And I found it very interesting that one of the first things you said was, don't think about love as a noun. Think about it as an active verb. It's not a thing. It's something that you do all the time.
Right. And in fact, there is a number of requirements for love. And one of the things I talk about is that love is really listening. And love is also giving, and it's receiving, it's respecting, it's disciplining and confronting, and it's also forgiving and it's playing. And then I go through each of those and tell various stories. And I can pick out one of those, such as, well, love is giving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I do, of course, is a lot of marriage counseling. And what I see in marriages is that after a period of time, people stop giving to each other. She stops complimenting him on his great physique, or she stops buying him little presents, and he rarely tells her, you know, gosh, you did a terrific job the other day with the house, or you have gorgeous hair, or I just love your laugh so much. And so what happens is that people start to disengage from the relationship. And one of the things that I really push couples to do is to give and give and give. And one of my requirements now when I see people in therapy is that I make them, I mean, this is a homework requirement, is that you do 5 nice things for your mate every day, and you write those on a Post-it. And then you give your mate the Post-it at the end of the day. And then he does 5 things for you, and he gives those to you. And what happens is that if I get those 5 things on a Post-it, I can say, oh, yeah, my husband did fix coffee this morning. He did tell me my hair looked nice. He did offer to stop by the cleaners for me. Just 5 little things. And then so what that does is it sort of like gets me again back into thinking what he is doing for me. And it also keeps me sort of on the stick, having me do things for him. And so that would be one of the suggestions I would make in terms of revitalizing a marriage and giving. I also use the quote, which is, give and give until you wave goodbye. And I often tell people that, give and give until you wave goodbye. Because I believe that if we keep giving in a relationship all the way to our goodbye, we would have fewer goodbyes in life. But people stop before the actual end of the relationship. So that's one of the requirements of love.
Before we get to the to our phone calls, you also talk about receiving as
yes.
an element of love. And I think for a lot of us, we kind of enjoy giving, and it's more difficult. We're not as comfortable receiving something. We don't know how to receive. We want to act very humble
right.
or say, oh, I don't deserve this at all.
In fact, in our office, we're always kidding each other, say, thank you, Doris. Say thank you, Michaeline, because when we give each other strokes, we want people that they know that they got a stroke. They work very hard to get strokes. You know, you get a stroke, and then you should be able to say thank you. So you should learn actually to receive. What I find is that women tend to be better givers, and men tend to be receivers. And it's kind of like the way our society brings us up. And in fact, people who are outer focused, people who are kind of looking at the outside world always and checking on kids and checking on, you know, if everything's working okay, kind of the people that watch the hearth, those tend to be people who are givers, and then there are people who are receivers. And I don't think one is better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
You may be very good at giving and not so good at receiving, and so what you have to do is work on the receiving. Or you may be very good at playing, but what you're not very good at is disciplining and confronting your children. So there's a variety of things you do in terms of love, and some of them you have to work on a little bit more, beef up your skills in that area. I mean, you're an outer-directed person, as I am, and so we tend to be more givers. But if you're more of a receiver, then what you have to do is learn to be more of a giver. And if you're more of a giver, you learn to be more of a receiver.
In the book, however, you sort of generalize, and there's nothing wrong with that because
right.
you're talking in general.
Correct.
About women being more, a little bit more outer directed,
right.
men being more inner directed. And it struck me that maybe if they would listen to each other a little bit more, and the women would hear the men saying, you need to be a bit more inner-directed and
take care of yourself more.
And vice versa. And the men hear the women saying, you need to be more giving or outer-directed. This might solve a lot of communication problems, too.
Right. And men actually do say that, because I've had men in therapy say, my wife doesn't stop and take care of herself. She won't join a tennis group. She won't go out in the evening. She always thinks she has to be around taking care of the family. She should go exercise. So there's a lot of guys that are out there who want their wives to take care of themselves. Women are always saying about men, however, he doesn't focus on me, he doesn't pay attention to me, he doesn't ask me about my day. So what they're actually asking for is to be given to more.
Interesting. Let's go to a couple of phone calls right now. Meg joins us from Chesterfield. Hi there, Meg. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. A number of things you've said while I was on hold really made me think about a lot of situations that I've been in. But most the thing that most touched me was the man on the coffee line.
You know him too, huh?
Well, I've run into a lot of them. I've just moved here from New York City, spent all my life in New York working as a law librarian. And I had run into a lot of men and women who behaved that way. And I think that we've enabled this behavior. When someone came crashing into my office and demanded that I drop everything and do something, most times I would do it because those were the people who, you know, got things done. And they behaved this way towards practically everyone in the office. And on a few occasions, I did get up my courage, and I would call them on this behavior and say, look, you know, you can ask me in a nice way, and I'll do it just as fast and just as well. And actually, a lot of those people became my friends, and people in the office would say to me, how do you get along with that monster? I think that even some of the young associates came into the office, came into practicing law, behaving this way. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the women who were able to get ahead got ahead because of this kind of behavior. And as I say, I think we enable a lot of it. It's very hard to confront someone like that.
I think it is hard to confront someone, because what happens is they frequently turn their confrontation around and they make it your problem, particularly somebody that has an anger issue. But I think hurrah for you, because it sounds like you're not a person that got angry back, but what you did was you confronted the behavior and you said, you know, you get a lot further if you're nicer with me.
And that's all
you have to do.
And you find out you're actually dealing with a fairly reasonable person, too. They actually listened to you.
Right.
A matter of maturity came with that. As I got older, I realized that in some cases I was a lot older than these people. And I decided that I demanded a certain amount of respect. I see the coffee situation very often when a young person in a service position is confronted by someone like this. They back down rather than have a confrontation or making an issue of it or saying to them, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go back online.
Right.
My mother had a wonderful saying. Very often we would be standing online in the supermarket and an old person would go to the head of the line and no one would challenge them because they were older. And on one occasion, my mother said to the person, old age is no excuse for bad manners.
Ooh, very good.
And I've always remembered that.
Very good.
And I think what your mom did was she really gave you courage, and probably courage to take on the issue, but not take it on in a mean way, but take it on in a good way. I also agree with you that we have given ourselves way too much permission to be rude. And I think we could start demanding of people that they not be rude. And I think if it became company policy that people were not rude, it didn't matter. You're not rude to the secretaries. You are not rude to your coworker. I think what would happen is we would see a change, but companies allow that to happen. It's sort of like it becomes the consistency principle. This is what happens in this company. Everybody's rude, so it's okay to be rude. And you could change that by having a new policy where politeness and patience were the thing that we particularly pushed. You know, one of the things that I tell people is to, instead of saying, why are you rude? Because people will say, well, because I got so much to do. You know, I mean, I only had one item to buy, and she had about 12. But ask yourself how you are rude. And that makes a very big difference. Well, you know, sometimes I'm rude by pushing ahead in line. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm rude by having kind of a curt tone in my voice. Sometimes I'm rude when I stand at the checkout counter and I jiggle from one foot to the other and, you know, fold my arms and say, hey, I could do this faster and better, right? So always ask yourself how as opposed to why. And I think then you move into that impartial observer position of yourself, and then you can become more aware and start changing some of those things.
Megan Chesterfield, thank you so much for your call. Good to hear from you. We're going to take another break, come back, continue this conversation with Doris Wild-Helmering and with you when you call 382-8255, 382-TALK. It's St. Louis on the Air on 90.7 KWMU. This is St. Louis on the Air. I'm Mark Minnelli. Doris Wild-Helmering is our guest today. She's a psychotherapist and columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Her latest book is called Sensibility, Expanding Your Sense of Awareness for a 21st Century Life. And you can join the conversation. As always, it just takes a phone call, 382-8255, 382-TALK. A caller who didn't want to stay with us, although asked us to talk about how depression can affect one's behavior, and it can really be debilitating. We keep hearing more and more about depression. It seems more and more people are suffering from it or believe that they are, but whatever, it can be debilitating.
It's terrible, and I think if you have an inability to sleep, or if you always want to sleep, if you have lost weight or gained a particularly large amount of weight, if you're more irritable, sometimes you'll see depression manifesting itself in sort of an irritability and not wanting to be around other people.
It's harder to communicate with other people, isn't it?
Exactly. It's like you've lost your joy or your zest in life. What I suggest to people is, oh my gosh, go see someone. Because now we have good medications out there. And I wouldn't have suggested this as a therapist years ago, but mm-hmm. today we have wonderful medications out there that really can be adjusted to the person, and they can get help from these medications within 4 to 6 weeks. The other part of that is to start changing your behaviors in some ways, and that might be to get on an exercise program. Maybe you need to switch jobs. Maybe you need to learn how to deal more effectively with one of your adolescents. So what you want to do is do two things. It's two-pronged the way you deal with depression, and that's the way all the research shows. One is that you get into some psychotherapy, start changing behavior, or the other one is that, and the other one combination is that you go see someone who can actually put you on medication. There's two kinds of depressions I talk about. One is clinical, mm-hmm. and the other is situational. And a clinical depression happens when there's a chemical change in the brain. We're not really quite sure everything that goes on, but we know that there's a chemical change. And that person really needs a push in terms of medication. But then there's also situational depression, and that happens because we lose a parent, we're having trouble on our job, one of our kids is not doing what she's supposed to be doing, we have trouble in our marriage, her husband leaves us, has an affair. And so what happens is we live with that situation for a long period of time, and then we start to slide either into a clinical depression or we just stay with that situational depression. But that can actually be treated through psychotherapy, the situational depression, where you don't need to be taking medication, but you do have to change your behavior. And my gosh, there is help for depression. There's really no excuse. Like I say, if you have anxiety attacks, again, get help. Don't keep toughing it out, because there are people that can help you with anxiety attacks. There are people that can help you with depression.
And yet it keeps you, in a way, from reaching out. You are depressed. You don't see how there's any light at the end of the tunnel. You're not communicating with other people. But
I think that if you really care about someone, if you love them, you are giving, and you are giving yourself in that way, and you are also confronting the situation.
I want to come back to that, but we also want to talk with Donna, who is in her car right now. Hello, Donna.
Ooh, I'm glad it's me. How are you today?
Just fine, thank you.
Great. Let's see here. I wanted to ask...
Doris?
Uh-huh. Well, couldn't get your last name together there.
No, but just call me Doris.
I'm one of those angry, impatient people.
Okay.
And I really don't enjoy being like this. And I think I'm like this not because there's some genetic programming, but I think that I'm the oldest child, and I got it all. I mean, nobody in my immediate family taught me how to appropriately deal with anger. Now, I'm the one that got the most of it. My brother and sister are nothing like me in terms of being instantly angry.
Well, you probably have that genetic push, that irritability, excitability quotient, but good for you for taking responsibility, because, you know, genetics is only a very small part of it ultimately,
right,
when we look at it. All right, here's what you do. You're willing to change, right?
Oh, most definitely. Let me just pose two quick questions to you.
Sure.
Number one, I want to be able, my anger is so instant that I've tried very hard to interrupt it. And, you know, I can usually figure out why I'm angry, but the problem is trying to interrupt it before, you know, I say something rude. That's point number one. I want to learn how to interrupt it. And then point number two is, you were talking about the issue of manners and things like that. Because growing up in my household, everybody's actions and activity was way over the top. I know it's very difficult to believe, but at 38, I really have no idea what good manners are.
Okay.
So even if I interrupt it, I kind of even don't know what normal is, and that's where I have the difficulty.
Well, I suspect you know more what's normal than not, but I'm not going to address that right this moment. First of all, let's talk about how you interrupt it. First of all, you said you know why you're angry, and what I would challenge you about is, how are you angry? You know, do you screw up your face? Do you use bad words? You know, do you go into the attack with the other person? Now, you don't have to answer that right now, but ask yourself within your head, how am I angry? And then the other person that I would say definitely to you is, say to yourself 2,000-3,000 times a day, I choose not to be angry. I choose to stay in control. And I tell people this all over the country, because that works. And if you will do this just today and tomorrow, what you will find is you will be getting in control of your anger. Because what will happen is, instantly, remember, within less than a second, you're going to be mad. And then instantly, that thought, I choose not to be angry, I choose to stay in control, will pop into your head, and you will immediately get more rational again. That's sort of going to be like the dam for you. It's going to hold back the flood of anger. And that technique works. We have proof that it works. There's been research that it works. So I choose not to be angry. I choose to stay in control. A lot of times people have a hard time with that. They think, how could saying something 2,000-3,000 times a day work? Well, it does work. And so all you have to do is try it. And you try it when you're sitting at the stop sign. Try it when you're taking a shower in the morning. And over and over and over, you say that particular phrase. You know, you're right about thinking that you have to prepare before the anger-provoking situation occurs. And the reason is it's sort of like a marathon runner. There's no way we could go out and run a marathon. However, if you started training for a marathon, then you might be able to run one. And you've got to go into training to start dealing with your anger. And as a child, in that one way, your folks failed you, because they didn't teach you how to control your anger. And had they taught you how to control your anger and taught you how to handle the situation differently, even though you will always be a hot burner, you're going to always have to deal with that particular issue, you could have been able to deal with it more effectively.
She also, Donna also talks about something I find very interesting, is how things worked in her family in terms of manners, and how the family behaves within the family is one thing, because there's a lot of dynamics that go on within a family that don't easily translate into the outside world.
That's absolutely correct.
You have to separate that.
That's absolutely correct. And the other thing, and one thing that I believe you could do is to take a look around at the people that you think behave really well, or sort of like a little regal or a little royal, and pick out one of those people and then start patterning yourself after that person as opposed to patterning yourself after what you learned as a child. The other thing you can do is you can go to a bookstore, you can go to the library, and you can pick up a book on manners, and you can actually read that book on manners. Most people, though, once they reach adulthood, know how to behave. They just give themselves permission to behave in somewhat of an unacceptable way.
I want to kind of go back for a minute, and we were talking about depression and how it can be so difficult to overcome, because it just seems to it prevents you from getting the help that you need, which is readily available, and it sort of snowballs. And just as depression does, so do things like suffering and disappointment. And these become so dominating in our thought processes. If we have a big disappointment in our career, in our marriage, and then the suffering that goes along with it, if we have a loss, for example, suffering is natural, but lots of times we let it take over our lives.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, you know what? Everyone has pain and suffering in their life, but it's really what I say is how we deal with it that makes a difference. And some people are just more effective in dealing with it. They have more resiliency, or we say that they're much more emotionally hardy than other people. One way, however, I think we tend to keep our suffering going is that we keep thinking about the event. So suppose you were fired from a fairly good job and you've never been able to recapture another job like that job. So every time you think about being fired, or every time you think about all the work you did on that particular job, you start to feel bad. One of the things I would strongly suggest is you stop thinking those thoughts. Now, every time one of those thoughts pops into your head about your job and being fired, you've got to say, I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about that. And you might even have to keep saying that. I'm not thinking about that. I'm not going there. Because if you go there, what's going to happen is you're going to feel lousy and miserable. So you are the one that control your thoughts. And you might even have to sing a song out loud to control your thoughts. But don't go there. You know, what I say to myself is, oh, so Doris, you want to feel bad today, right? So keep thinking about that disappointment in your life. And what happens is I'm going to push myself into feeling badly. Where if I decide that I'm going to close that feeling off, or close those thoughts off, then I'm going to close that feeling off. Even for people who experience the loss of a child, which is the worst thing I believe a human can experience, one of the things that I ask them to do is to not give themselves permission to think about that child. Now, this is not in the very beginning, but after the first 5 or 6 months, is to start closing some of their pain off, to kind of encapsulate that pain. And what we do is we talk about, you may think about your child 5 minutes every hour, but that's all. And I want you to wear a watch. And when you catch yourself thinking about Susie, I want you to time it, and then only 5 minutes that particular hour. And even if you have to say an affirmation over and over, the one I give people is, I choose to live each moment in an accepting, relaxed, and conscious way. Because what that does is that puts them right in the now, and it gets them out of mourning the past, and it also gets them out of mourning the future. Because that's what loss of a child is, not just mourning the present, but the past as well as the future. And the other thing is, like, I have a fellow who I just love this guy, and he came to me for therapy, and he had lost his daughter. And one of the things is that he has done is decide to go to church every morning. And so every morning he goes to church, and that's his time to think about and really honor his daughter. And then when he walks out of church, he's got to cut off thoughts of her, because if he doesn't, he'll drive himself crazy. The other thing is that he's got a family. He's got other children. He has a wife. He has a job to attend to. So he can't always be thinking about that child, but he is never going to forget that child. That child is an important part of his life, but he has to encapsulate that pain or limit that pain. People have mates that cheat on them, and they drive themselves crazy obsessing about that affair and thinking about it, and why did it happen, and I was a good wife. Well, every time you go there, you're going to feel pain. You may not be able to help the fact that you're standing in line at the grocery store and you wind up seeing a headline on the National Enquirer that somebody is cheating on somebody else, and you're immediately catapulted into thinking about how your husband cheated on you. But you can close off those thoughts. You do not have to keep obsessing and holding on to them. Prayer is one way to stop obsessing, because if you have a favorite prayer and you say that over and over and over again, that's a way to close some of those thoughts off.
We're going to take another break. Donna, I want to thank you very much. Donna reached us from her car. More of your phone calls for Doris Wild-Helmering when we come back in just 1 minute on St. Louis on the Air on 90.7 KWMU. It's St. Louis on the Air. I'm Mark Minnelli. My guest today, Doris Wild-Helmering, psychotherapist, columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and author of the book Sensibility, Expanding Your Sense of Awareness for a 21st Century Life. Let's head back to the phones real quickly. Rick's in his car. Hello, Rick.
Hi. Hey, I find lack of eye contact to be particularly insulting to me at retail or in a service industry. I'll give you an example when I'm, for instance, go to a fast food restaurant, and I'll order food and wait for it and pay for it, and never once will the retail person ever look me in the eye. And it's just the height of rudeness and impersonal rudeness to me. And I wonder, is there any technique to overcome that and to break through? I just think that's...
Huh.
Well, here's what I would do, okay, is I think I would compliment the person on something, such as... you go through a fast food line and you say, you know, I really like the French fries here. Generally, the person will look up and sort of nod or smile. Or you might say, gosh, that's a pretty scarf you have in your hair. Or thank you, I really appreciate the good service here. So somehow you give that person a compliment. And generally, they will look at you and they will respond or nod. You might not get a thank you, but they might respond and nod back. You know, a lot of times we get into thinking that we can't change somebody else. But if you change yourself, Rick, in the way you approach it, not to be critical, but to say, you know what, I think I'm going to get this person to look at me. Guess what? I think you will get that person to look at you. And a smile goes a long way.
Yeah,
like I used to
does.
Do this when I was younger. I'd say, I wonder if I could get these people to smile at me. And so I would smile, and guess what? They smiled back. So my behavior really did affect their behavior.
It's amazing how many people, if you're just walking down the street and you just happen to make eye contact with them and you just smile, invariably, they'll smile back. Very few people will just turn away.
Right. Or if they don't smile back, they're probably wondering, what in the heck you're smiling
about? Yeah.
But the reality is you still affected their behavior. You affected their thinking.
Made them at least think. Rick, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Charles is in Clayton. Hi there, Charles.
Hi. Doris, I wonder if you would speak a bit about... disciplining out of love. I'm a step-parent. I have a 17-year-old who I've been the dad of, male that I've been the dad of for about 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I need to bring something, my desire is to bring something to his life that I find very useful, that I don't know that his mother is able to do it.
Well, here's what I would do first of all. I would start with your wife, and I would ask her what she thinks about you disciplining her son. And even though you're the step-parent, I would check it out with mom first, because a lot of times step-parents are in very precarious positions, and they want to discipline, and they actually sometimes are able to see the problem better, or they see more of the problem than perhaps the natural parent. And so one thing you might want to do is to start with your wife and see what she thinks about what you want to say to your 17-year-old. And then if you get the go from her, then what I would do is go ahead and implement the plan. But if she says, I don't want you doing that, I think that then that's not a smart move to make.
Yeah, I think we're both on board about what he needs to do, something simple like, you know, it's not okay to not clean your room for three months.
Right.
Kind of thing. But and I usually would encourage her to speak to him about it. But it seems not to be a big priority to her, but she loves that I do this very well, that I'm very neat and clean. And I think that's something that young males need to learn to do and to have in their life. Because women are smart now. They're not interested in slobs for husbands.
Hey, you know, women were always smart.
Well,
but maybe
right.
They're getting more smart in how to deal with it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you have the go-ahead, go for it. And, you know, one thing I tell parents sometimes is you just simply say, hey, Mac, I want you to clean up your room. And then Mac doesn't, of course, clean up his room. And so then you say again, you know, maybe 2-3 days later, you know, Mac, if you don't clean up your room, you're not going to be able to go out on Friday night. And that's a way to cut through it all. You don't have to tell them what a slob or piggy is or point out all the ways that you cleaned up your room as a kid. You know, kids hate autobiographies of their parents or their step-parents. But what you want to do is to just have expectations. And having expectations is clearly an important part of love.
Charles, thanks a lot for your call. Charles Reach is from Clayton. We have a few minutes left, but I really want to cover a couple of topics with you. First of all, I've read a couple of things over the last 6 months in reference to the various tragedies which have occurred in high schools around the country, the mm-hmm. latest being Columbine High School near Denver. Columnists, reporters, parents, and kids said, and you always hear when these things happen, that counselors are being brought in mm-hmm. to help. And I heard from some columnists and students and their parents that they almost felt, in a way, compelled to grieve publicly, to tell people, strangers or whatever, the media, how they were feeling, as if you can't grieve privately anymore. They felt that as if they weren't being allowed to grieve privately or in their own way.
Well, I believe that it's a mistake. Now, I think it's important to have counselors available. And so I think that a school district certainly should have counselors available when there is a tragedy or when there's a tragedy like the Oklahoma City bombing. However, I think it should be a person's choice whether they want to go talk to someone or not. And a lot of times in that kind of a very traumatic situation, what the kids, I think, need is to be able to relate to their peers and to tell their stories over and over with their peers. Those are the people that experienced that other person that may no longer be alive, not counselors. They didn't experience the same kind of a thing. So I think that those children need to be left alone and choose to grieve how they want to grieve. And if they want to see a counselor, great. If they want to go to a class on grief and death, that's fine. That's okay. But if they do not want to do that, then it's okay to let those children not grieve in that kind of a way because, like you said, we all really do grieve differently. But that I would make the counselors available for a period of a year because mm-hmm. some kids are not ready to talk about an issue for 6 months or 9 months. Or, you know, a wonderful time to talk with your kids is when you're in the car and you're driving in the car if you're quiet. All of a sudden, the child pops up with something. And if you continue to remain quiet, what happens is they give you more information. So I think you're right on about that issue.
And finally,
maybe because we agree, I'm not
maybe
sure.
Maybe so. Mark. maybe so. But it struck me because they implied also that if they didn't want to grieve in this way, they felt as if, you know, people were looking at them like there was actually something wrong.
Well, you know,
there.
I used to occasionally see kids in therapy. I don't see children in therapy anymore, but a parent would call and be very concerned about their child. And so, you know, I would see the child, an 11, 12-year-old child. And so I'd say, so what's going on, you know, with your life or whatever? And they tell me about their peers and what was happening. And they didn't have any problem with the fact that their mom and dad were fighting or this particular incident happened or that particular incident happened. So, you know, as adults, we do see things differently than children. I mean, we all see the world differently. And I think we need to, when I talk about respect, that's one thing you do is that you try to look at how your mate or your child sees the world differently and to really respect that.
And also, and we only have 2 minutes left, okay. And this is a big question to ask, but you also talk in the book about talking with God and praying. Are you saying here, is it sort of like there are no atheists in a foxhole sort of idea?
Well, here's the deal, is that when I wrote this book, in fact, my editor had the same question, is why are you having a chapter on prayer? Well, I believe that prayer is a way of asking a higher power, God, to take care of you, to help you out. I also know it's part of resiliency. Having a belief in God says that, hey, I know somebody else is out there. And that it is really, in some ways, kind of a therapeutic technique as well. Because, you know, when someone comes into my office and they're religious, one of the things that I have them do is to pray harder. Or to go to a special service that they think would help. Why wouldn't I use that? And prayer has always been an important part of my life. And in fact, I frequently say, thanks God for giving me a religion, because I think that during my traumas in my life, I have really leaned on prayer. And so if people have that as part of their life, then they should be able to lean on that whenever. And for people who are atheists, who choose not to believe, that's okay. Then that particular chapter is not going to be helpful to them. It's like every technique or everything that someone suggests is not going to be helpful to you personally. But for me, prayer is very important, and I think for a lot of people it's important, and so I included that in this book.
Has being a columnist for 20 years changed how you do your work?
Well, I don't know if it's changed how I do my work as much as being a therapist has changed how I do my work, because I see so many problems, and people are always coming to me to help them, you know, solve their problems. And so I think through the years, I've looked at things differently. I think I've become more tolerant, more patient, less angry. It's actually changed me.
Doris Wilde-Helmring, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me
again. Good to meet you. Doris Wilde-Helmring's latest book is called Sensibility, 2 words, Expanding Your Awareness for a 21st Century Life. Coming up tomorrow, a discussion of the speech disorder, aphasia. St. Louis on the Air is a production of 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for your phone calls today. I'm Mark Minnelli.